The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. It's time for Christmas.
Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
Sure, Charlie Brown. I can tell you what Christmas is all about. Lights, please. And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them. And they were sore afraid, and the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. You shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God, and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
Christmas, the celebration of the birth of Christ, is for many merely a festive season. For others, it's also family time. Kids come home from college. The grandkids fly in and out of state. Stores certainly don't mind the holiday much either. Gift-giving season means a big boost for the economy, but it's often debated. How did this holiday evolve into what it is today? We'll take a look at the history and the meaning of Christmas. Salem host Michael Medved begins with the day, December 25th.
The truth of the matter is that there is very, very little agreement on the actual date in which Jesus Christ was born. One of the few things that virtually all scholars seem to agree is that he wasn't born in wintertime. Now, I know that's terrible to say, but it is very important to understand that Christmas is a relatively recent holiday in terms of its universal acceptance. The early followers of Jesus Christ weren't concerned about marking his birthday, partially because they expected his imminent return. They expected him to come back to earth at any time, so why bother creating a special birthday festival? And one of the earliest and most influential church fathers, the great scholar Origen, who was born about 185 A.D., preached that it would be wrong to honor Christ in the same way that Pharaoh and Herod were honored. Birthdays, he said, were for pagan gods and rulers, not for the Son of God and the Messiah. Therefore, there always was some opposition to honoring Christ's birth, but that didn't prevent early Christian scholars from trying to speculate on when he was born. Clement of Alexandria, who was born about the year 150 A.D., determined that from everything he could gather, Jesus Christ was born on May 20th. Others argued for April 18th, April 19th, or May 28th. The one thing that you'll see that all these dates have in common is springtime, and that makes a great deal of sense, because one of the very few details you'll find in the gospel accounts of the birth of Jesus Christ is that it was at a time when the shepherds were with their flocks in the fields. That could not have been in December. Because what we do know about the traditions of ancient Judea is that at that time it was very common for shepherds to take their flocks indoors, to put the sheep inside so they wouldn't get cold at night starting in November, and they wouldn't bring them out again until March. It was only beginning in about the year 270 that people began arguing for observing a feast of the Nativity on December 25th. One of the reasons that the early church fathers did that is because it was already a big holiday season. So it would fit if you were going to try to reach out to pagans, if you were going to try to reach out to people who weren't yet Christian, it would fit to try to incorporate a Christian basis for a holiday that already existed. What holiday was it? Well, in Roman times, in particular, it was a big old holiday called Saturnalia, the Feast of Saturn. Lots of drinking and eating and feasting and gift-giving and greenery brought in. But that Saturnalia feast began December 17th in the Roman calendar. It was also centered around the winter solstice, another holiday that specifically took place on December 25th was the sacred birthday of Mithras. This was a Persian cult that had a lot of points of similarity with Christianity, at least superficial similarities. Mithras, this Persian god, was a warrior god, a warrior for light, and he expected his followers to also be warriors for goodness and light. So there was direct competition between the Mithraeus and the Christians. And part of the decision of the early Christian church fathers to celebrate Christmas on December 25th was not only to co-opt Saturnalia, this big popular Roman feast, but to specifically appeal to the very key people in the Roman army who were celebrating the Feast of Mithras by appropriating that day, December 25th. Remember, there had been objections from some of the early church fathers to celebrating his birthday at all. Easter was already well established. The idea of celebrating his resurrection made a lot of sense. And in the Eastern church, they had already begun celebrating the Feast of the Epiphany. That was on January 6th. Now, this will help to explain what lots of people wonder about all the time. The 12 days of Christmas. What are the 12 days of Christmas? The 12 days of Christmas are the days in between Christmas itself and then the 12th night, right? Like the title of the Shakespeare play, the 12th day, which is January 6th, which is the Feast of the Epiphany. For the Eastern Church, January 6th marked both the day that they celebrated and observed the birth of Jesus Christ and his baptism. But then later, when the mainstream church authorized December 25th as the day, the Eastern Church kept the Feast of the Epiphany 12 days after Christmas to remember and to observe and to commemorate the baptism of Jesus. For the Western Church, that day, January 6th, Feast of the Epiphany, represented the day that the Magi finally arrived with their gifts for the Christ child. The idea of transforming these pagan observances, like the Feast of Mithras and Saturnalia, into a holy observance for religious Christians was defended by one theologian as early as 320. He said, "We hold this day holy, not like the pagans because of the birth of the sun, but because of him who made the sun." And another early scholar commented that it was appropriate that Christians celebrate the birth of him who came as the light of the world at the time that pagans were celebrating simply the physical light. But it wasn't until nearly 1,000 years after the holiday originated that it was universally observed, that traditions began to emerge that everyone would recognize and that everyone would observe together. But all of this borrowing and all of this transformation of various pagan celebrations didn't sit well with absolutely everybody, because there were some church fathers who thought very early on that people carried things too far. For instance, there's a fascinating commentary by a guy named Gregory of Nazianzen, who died in the year 389 AD. And he was a prelude to all those people who say people have commercialized Christmas. They're not celebrating the true spirit of Christmas. They're taking it too far. Here's what he said back in the 4th century AD. He urged that the celebration of the Christmas festival be conducted after an heavenly and not after an earthly manner. And he warned his congregants against feasting to excess, dancing and crowning the doors. But this did not stop people from all over Europe, and particularly from England, from celebrating the holiday in a very festive way, in terms of drinking, card playing, singing, dancing, dressing up. There was all kinds of behavior that was sanctioned, that was part of the Christmas festivities that during the rest of the year the church would frown upon. But all of this celebration and all of this merriment didn't sit well, particularly after the Protestant Reformation. One of the hallmarks of Martin Luther's message was to clear away from the entire church calendar all the feasts and saints' days. He had a tough time with the whole idea of saints and the deification of saints and the Catholic obsession with relics and name days and saints' days. And the fact is that Christmas was one of only many, many feasts in the old Catholic Church, and Luther tried to get rid of almost all of them, so that some of his followers in the years after the Reformation also felt that Christmas was a danger, that Christmas was inappropriate. Why? Because it wasn't mentioned in the Bible. One of the messages of the Reformation was go back to biblical text, follow what's in the Bible, don't add to it, don't subtract from it. And nobody could find any references to Christmas at all in the Bible. Therefore, some of the early Puritans, particularly in England, strong followers of the Protestant Reformation, were very much opposed to Christmas. Part of the logic behind that argument was expressed by an American Puritan of a later generation, Ezra Stiles, who later became one of the early presidents of Yale College, had said it very well. He said, "Had it been the will of Christ that the anniversary of his nativity should have been celebrated, he would have at least let us have known the day." Now, nobody said it was popular. Ordinary people, they might believe that the Puritans had a lot of religious substance on their side, but they enjoyed Christmas. They enjoyed the caroling, the going out and singing. They enjoyed the celebration, the dressing up, the revelry, the drinking. And this kind of struggle between people who rejected Christmas, who thought it was a danger, who thought it was inappropriate, and people who loved it, that kind of struggle also carried over to the United States. Because, of course, the Puritans not only had some power in England, and for a while had power over the whole country, but they are the people who established New England, who established the colonies of Connecticut, Massachusetts first, of course, Connecticut, Rhode Island, though Rhode Island was a little bit more relaxed in its attitude, Vermont later, New Hampshire. All of those colonies frowned on Christmas and frowned on it very strongly. Well, this controversy continued because, of course, the New England colonies weren't the only colonies in young America. There were also southern colonies, and the southern colonies going all the way back to Captain John Smith, that's right, in Jamestown, starting in 1607, those colonies enjoyed their Christmas celebrations, and they liked to celebrate them in the old-fashioned way, getting roaring drunk and shooting off guns.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
He inherited a whole bunch of money and then began giving it away. And in one particular case, he gave it away in a very memorable manner, putting gold into three bags and then throwing those bags with gold into a window to help three girls who were destitute, who were, according to the story, about to be forced by their father into a life of prostitution.
The Town Hall Review will be right back. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's that time of the year, and if you're listening to this in your car right now, odds are good that you're doing some last-minute Christmas shopping. You may be in a panic, you probably are stuck in traffic, or you can't get out of a parking lot. Well, I feel for you, and we'll keep you entertained and enlightened on this marvelous seasonal day. Again, here's Michael Medved on Christmas.
One James Lamar remembers his youth in colonial Georgia. And he wrote that me and 10 or 8 of my friends would arm ourselves with anything that would shoot. We'd do so on Christmas Eve. Later in the night, we set out for miles and miles, visiting every house far and near in the whole neighborhood. At every house, we sneaked as close to the bedroom as possible. With cocked guns in hand, we became as still as death, waiting for the whispered command, "Fire!" And by the time the man of the house had fallen over a few chairs and the women screamed and the baby squalled a little, they found out it was Christmas Eve. Sometimes They invited us boys in for Christmas pies and things, including perhaps a little eggnog. So they were having a merry time. There was all the difference in the world between the South and the North, particularly New England, in the celebration of Christmas. This was one sectional struggle that the South ultimately won. The South was a place where Christmas was most revered, where people were most enthusiastic about it. George Washington was enthusiastic about it. He liked to feast and to hunt on Christmas and would often observe Christmas Day with a special hunt in honor of the day. And he also would go to church. That was part of his personal tradition. So it took a while for Christmas to catch hold for the entire country. And one side note about why that even was a good thing during the struggle for independence during the Revolutionary War. One of the key battles, the most inspiring battles of the whole Revolution, was the Battle of Trenton. And you may remember the story. That's Washington crossing the Delaware. Well, he did that on Christmas of 1776. And one of the reasons that the Americans were able to prevail is because they surprised the Hessians, the mercenaries who worked for the British, and the British at Trenton, New Jersey, because they were all drunk. They had been celebrating Christmas. They were big celebrators of Christmas. But the Americans were not. So how did things change? What happened? Part of what happened is immigration. Because most of the immigration that came to the United States after the War for Independence was Catholic immigration. A lot of Irish people, a lot of Germans from the south of Germany, and Catholic people have always brought with them a very strong attachment to Christmas. There was never the division within the Catholic community about the observance of Christmas that there was in the Protestant community. And part of what the immigrants also brought was diversity and increasing urbanization. And that meant that almost everybody, like it or not, ended up being exposed to the Christmas holiday. And when people were exposed, well, it looked pretty attractive. All of a sudden, you saw people who were singing and enjoying themselves and churches decorated with greenery. And that looked very appealing, even for people who might not have been raised that way. But by 1860, when the nation split apart in the war between the states, only 13 states had recognized Christmas as a legal holiday. 5 years later, by 1865, that number had gone from 13 states to 31 states. What happened? Well, the Civil War happened, the war between the states. And that helped to create a much more receptive climate for Christmas because of the nostalgic yearning that so many men on the front, on both sides, felt for Christmas at home. And because of the little gestures that occurred on the front lines when they would declare an unofficial Christmas truce between the blue and the gray. And people would exchange little gifts, sometimes some tobacco passed here or there, some coffee or some food or whatever either side had. And part of the recognition that people had, and this was something President Lincoln was very aware of, was that one of the ways to bind up the nation's wounds, to reconcile the nation after all of the bloodshed and the 600,000 dead of the war between the states, was through Christmas. So in 1870, just 5 years after the war ended, Congress voted and made Christmas for the first time a national formal holiday. But what about all that old-style New England Puritan opposition to Christmas? Where did it go? Well, to one extent, you could say that the old-style religiosity of the Puritans had begun to dissipate anyway. There was another factor as well. One of the aspects of New England and those areas of the country where Christmas hadn't been embraced was they're very commercial. And people began to understand in the 1850s and 60s that there was a lot of money to be made with Christmas. That while people were busy buying gifts, there were profits to be made. But there was something else. The objection to Christmas when it existed was an objection to a public holiday where people got together for big groups and big celebrations with lots of drunkenness and firing off weapons and dressing up in costumes. Well, in the early years of the 19th century, through Santa Claus, through Christmas trees, Christmas changed. It became a home-centered holiday, not a holiday of great big public celebrations, but a holiday where you waited at home for Santa to come down the chimney. You decorated your tree in your home. And with that kind of centrality of the home, it was much harder for Puritans or anyone else to object. Now, part of the big deal surrounding Christmas involved the figure of St. Nicholas, of Santa Claus. Now, here, it's a very, very long way from Myra, Turkey, to New York City. But that's a journey that we have to take if we want to understand why it was that Christmas ultimately conquered all of America and then conquered the entire world. Because part of the popularity is based on this saint of the old Catholic Church, who was the Bishop of Myra. It's near the modern town of Finike, Turkey. And he lived sometime in the 300s. We don't know that much about him. But one of the things we know is that he was born into a wealthy family. His parents died. He inherited a whole bunch of money and then began giving it away. And in one particular case, he gave it away in a very memorable manner, putting gold into three bags and then throwing those bags with gold into a window to help three girls who were destitute, who were, according to the story, about to be forced by their father into a life of prostitution. But St. Nick, St. Nicholas, the prototype for Santa Claus? Yeah, he was. Put the bags of gold through the window, and through his kindness, helped these girls live more satisfying, more uplifting lives. And his feast day was December 6th. And beginning really several hundred years after his death, throughout Europe, people began observing this feast day as a day particularly to honor children and to honor one another with gifts and feasting and St. Nicholas's memory. And part of what this involved was people conjuring up an image of St. Nicholas. He was usually portrayed not as anybody who was fat at all or jolly or round or anything like that, but a rather gaunt person who would be dressed up in red. He was a bishop in Turkey. And oh yeah, the name Santa Claus comes from the way that the Dutch would say the shortened version of Niklaus. Niklaus would be Klaus, Claus, and so Santa Claus would be the way you'd say Saint Claus. Sinterklaas, Santa Claus, and that's how it came to be known.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. When we return...
Now, what about this Kris Kringle name? Well, this is fascinating.
The Town Hall Review will be right back. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
Hello there. Good to see you again.
It's nice to see you.
You're awfully lucky, Mrs. Walker. Lovely little girl you have here.
Thank you. And Susan's the reason I asked you to drop down. She's a little confused, and I thought maybe you could help to straighten her out.
I'd be glad to.
Would you please tell her that you're not really Santa Claus? That there actually is no such person?
Well, I'm sorry to disagree with you, Mrs. Walker, but not only is there such a person, but here I am to prove it.
No, no, no. You misunderstand. I want you to tell her the truth. What's your name?
Kris Kringle. I'll bet you're in the first grade.
Second.
I mean your real name.
That is my real name.
We are talking today about Christmas, the history, the facts, the meaning, the celebration. And in this next segment, the beginning of Santa Claus. Here again is Michael Medved.
Now, what about this Kris Kringle name? Well, this is fascinating. Is part of what happened is with the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther and his followers wanted to get rid of all of the feast days for saints, wanted to get rid of all of the worship of saints, and St. Nicholas was no exception, despite the fact that he was so popular. It just seemed to them a way of distracting people from the appropriate worship of Jesus Christ and the return to scriptures. So what Luther saw personally was that even though people were willing to give up many saints, they weren't willing to give up St. Nicholas because they enjoyed that feast day so much and they associated him already with the Christmas season because obviously the feast day on December 6th was part of the Christmas season. So what Luther suggested is that instead of telling kids about St. Nicholas, who would bring them gifts, they tell the kids that the gifts would be brought by the Christ child himself. And they created imagery for children of the Christ child traveling around the world and giving gifts. Now, how do you say Christ child in German, which, of course, was Martin Luther's language? Christkindl. That's right, Christkindl. What does that sound like? Kris Kringle. That's where the name comes from. The German pronunciation of Christ child, Christkindl, Kris Kringle. And that became one of the names for Santa Claus also because, guess what? Martin Luther was not successful in replacing St. Nicholas with the Christ child. So how did we get to the gentle, jolly Santa Claus that we know today? Well, we got there courtesy of an Hebraic scholar, a very devout guy, a member of the Episcopal Church, somebody of Dutch Walloon ancestry, whose name was Clement Clark Moore. He was very much an academic. He helped found the General Theological Seminary. He knew seven or eight languages. He taught Oriental and Greek literature. His best-known publication was a huge two-volume dictionary of Hebrew called a Compendious Lexicon of the Hebraic Language. So this guy knew his stuff. So what was he doing writing one of the most famous poems ever written, known as The Night Before Christmas? Well, the story goes that in the year 1822, he was coming home from a Christmas party with his three daughters. He was coming home from Greenwich Village, and he was riding in a sleigh, and he started reciting to them this doggerel that he was making up about Santa Claus. And they loved it, and then later that night, he wrote it down, and then he read it to his family, and everybody in the family loved it. And then the next Christmas, he did the same. And people loved it, and it became sort of a family tradition. And a number of family friends said, Professor Moore, you really should publish this. This is great stuff. I mean, it was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. All of that? You publish. He said, no. He was embarrassed by it. He was a serious scholar. He didn't want to be known for this. Well, a family friend named Harriet Butler took his copy of it and copied it by hand. And then she snuck off to an out-of-town newspaper in Troy, New York, which, of course, is outside of New York City, where Professor Moore lived. And they published this poem anonymously, because Moore didn't want his name associated with it. It became an overnight sensation. And soon it was published all across the country, anonymously. And a few years later, Professor Moore said, "All right, I'm the guilty party. I wrote it." And in fact, he was able to make a few bucks out of it because later he actually published an authorized copy about 20 years later that had illustrations in it. And then later still, Thomas Nast did illustrations, the great political cartoonist, famous illustrations that showed Santa Claus very much as we know him today. And this is where he got that big broad belt. The red clothes were left over from his days as just a Catholic bishop, but the boots and the stocking cap and the long pipe, all of that was associated with the Dutch remembrance. And the whole idea of Santa Claus being fat, well, this apparently was a clear invention of Professor Moore. And it said that he based it on his Dutch gardener. This guy ends up being remembered for almost only, exclusively, one thing, and that is writing The Night Before Christmas, and creating the idea of Santa Claus as a jolly old elf.
Coming up.
Without religion, we are insignificant. Oh, we may be significant to our loved ones, and we should be. But in the final analysis, we're insignificant because we die, and that's it. That's it.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. We've heard from Michael Medved on Christmas and its origin. Medved, as many of you know, is Jewish, and for years he's been the first to defend his Christian friend's celebration of Christmas. Likewise, Salem host Dennis Prager will fiercely come to the aid of Christians defending Christmas. And though Jewish as well, Prager also realizes there's something very moving about Christmas.
It's a very special day and a very special period of time in the American calendar. I remember when I was in my early 20s, for the first time one year, I did not experience Christmas at all in the society that I happened to be located in. And in this case, it was Morocco, a Muslim country. And so there was no Christmas, at least not in the city that I was. And I assume the Christian population is quite small in Morocco. And I remember not understanding why I was a little down. I'm pretty good at, I don't know, is it called biofeedback? I'm pretty good at getting in touch with what's bothering me. Even then, at the age of, I guess, 20. And sure enough, it hit me. My God, it's December 25th. Nothing's happening that I'm used to. And that was it. And it really hit me. Wow, I had really come to rely on this date in this part of the year for a terrific feeling in society. And I was stunned myself because I was in a home that didn't observe it. And I figured, you know, how important could it be to me? But by golly, it really was important to me. And it has ever since been. And I just think it's very special. You see, here's the way I look at it. Life is filled with the meaning that we give it. And nothing approaches religion in terms of giving life meaning. Nothing does. Well, what I mean, look, I think that there are many things that give life meaning. The love of loved ones, of family and friends. I mean, those are huge. Religion alone is not sufficient. I just want to make that clear. I don't agree with people at all who feel that if they have their wonderful, true faith, that is sufficient to make life meaningful. No, religion is necessary, but not sufficient. Necessary, that's my challenge to the irreligious, and not sufficient, that's my challenge to the religious. It's absolutely necessary. I mean, to believe otherwise is to believe that we are ultimately meaningless creatures. And the atheists who are intellectually honest acknowledge that. I remember debating Carl Sagan, the late most popular astronomer in American history, and he said to me when I had a TV show some 10 years ago, he said, "Dennis, when I look into the heavens and I see how vast they are, I realize more and more how insignificant we are." Yeah, that's charming, isn't it? And that's true. Without religion, we do recognize how insignificant we are. That's the whole point. Without religion, we are insignificant. Oh, we may be significant to our loved ones, and we should be. But in the final analysis, we're insignificant because we die, and that's it. That's it. And 99.9999999% of us, virtually every human who's ever lived, will be forgotten eventually. That's the way it is, too. There is no immortality in this world. If there is immortality, it is in the next world. I always get a kick out of those who say, there is no afterlife. We live on through the good works that we have done. Well, it's a nice sentiment, but it's not true. Yeah, we live on. First of all, the people that our good works have touched, they also die. Secondly, the truth is the people who really live on the most are the people whose bad works have taken shape. Hitler lives, Stalin lives, Mao live on far more than almost all the good people on earth. There is virtually nobody who has done as much good as Hitler, Stalin, and Mao did evil. So this notion of we live on through our good works is you, if you want to really live on, you might want to do massive evil. Then you really get to live on. If that's the theory that we're going to live by, that there is no afterlife, but we get to live on through our good works or through the works that we do to others in this world. Now, let's be honest, folks. if there is no God and religion is a way of reaching God, if there is none, then life doesn't have any ultimate meaning. It has what we call immanent meaning, meaning right here and now, in the fact that it's meaningful to get up in the morning and go to work. It's meaningful to hug your children. That, yeah, there's meaning in that. But in the final analysis, this is just a big, bad coincidence. So when I watch whatever religion it is, so long as it's doing good in the world, I watch the religious pageantry as I watch the Catholic Church and the Vatican with awe and a wonderful sense of people aspiring to the highest possible that the human can aspire to. It touches me deeply, and I love it. I have a religious soul. Not everybody does, which is a tragedy. I think, though, almost everybody can cultivate one, but I acknowledge that not everybody can. There have been people who, for reasons that I can't always figure out, people I know, some whom I revere, that just cannot have a religious faith. They respect it. They can even enjoy it, but don't have any. Something to keep in mind when you hear that cliche, oh, there's no afterlife, we live on through the good that we do in this world. Now, what if you can't do good in this world? What if you die at the age of 5?
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Stay with us for the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. On Christmas Day, Dennis Prager is on the air talking about this marvelous day and what it means to America and the world. At one point, he was challenged by a caller who suggested religious people do bad things. Here's his response.
Of course religious people are going to do bad. And it sickens me. There's no evil that sickens me more than religious evil, because they not only do the evil that an atheist evil would do, like communists, but they also give a terrible name to God and religion, which ends our possibilities for goodness, because goodness will not survive without good religion. So I have a particular anger at people who do evil in the name of God. But the fact is that more good has been done in the name of God in our particular religious sphere. I am not an advocate of all religion. I am interested in all religion, deeply so. I am touched by good people in any religion. But the religion that has done best has been, in the United States of America, a variation on the Jewish and Christian theme called Judeo-Christian values. Not Judeo-Christian theology. Jews and Christians believe different things. But what Christians did by taking the Jews' scriptures and applying them to the real life of America has been uniquely successful in making good, including the abolition of slavery. It is the naive, or those with an agenda, who say, well, all this big talk about this Judeo-Christian civilization, but it allowed slavery. But the question is not whether or not slavery existed here. It existed everywhere on earth. The question is not why was there slavery. That was all over. It's universal. The question is, why did a civilization stop slavery? It was not stopped elsewhere. It was not stopped within the Islamic world. It was not stopped within the Hindu world. It was not stopped in many places. It wasn't stopped in the pre-Columbus world of the religions of the Western Hemisphere. It was stopped by largely Christians. And basically, Judeo-based Christians. That's why we have, as I always point out, on the Liberty Bell, a verse from the Jewish scripture put on by Christians. This melange has been this staggering achievement of this free society called America was made possible by Christians rooted in Jewish scriptures. That's why I am fighting so hard to maintain the centrality of the Bible in American life.
Thanks for joining us on this edition of the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.